Hello and welcome to the Government Technology Insider Podcast. In today's world, the threat of cyber attacks has become a critical part of any discussion about how to make a robust cybersecurity plan. With looming threats from foreign and other unidentified cyber actors, federal organizations today must work to prevent attacks when they are able to and respond to attacks that occur quickly and effectively. Cybersecurity is not a new focus for the federal government, but with bad actors becoming more vicious, the government is taking a hard look at how they protect their most valuable data. That is why today we are speaking with Cameron Sherry, CTO and Vice President of Pre-Sales Engineering at Dell EMC Federal. Cameron's impressive career has largely been focused on providing strategy, execution, leadership, and innovation to the cybersecurity industry. He also speaks with a certain air of authority, as his main purview at Dell is within the civilian government, Department of Defense, and the intelligence community. Cameron, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today about this topic. I know I am very excited to hear your advice on how to bolster government IT and defend cybersecurity.
Kevin, thank you. What an absolute pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, I say that we just jump right in. So, Cameron, if you could, can you give us a brief recap of the current federal cybersecurity environment? More specifically, can you shed any light on what the federal government has been dealing with in the past year, just with everything from the pandemic to just the transition to more remote work?
Sure. Yeah. What a great opening salvo question. It's been fascinating. With the pandemic, it's really, I'll call it, thawed the frozen middle of leadership in the government. And what I mean by that is the pandemic forced a few things that became truisms, I think, that none of us wanted to face in any altruistic sense, Kevin, to be candid with you, pre-pandemic, because, you know, mission execution was happening. And some of those truisms, to be very clear, are we can safely work from anywhere, depending on the data classification, the mission you're supporting, obviously, from a restricted or classified perspective. It does get trickier, there's no question. But I'm happy to report that although it's been a trying environment, and let's be very clear, the federal government has seen an extraordinary rise in the number of attacks and cyber attacks, whether they be phishing schemes or just traditional nation state sponsored activities. However, we have demonstrated that there is a reasonable sense of resiliency in the cyber infrastructure for the federal government, Department of Defense, and intelligence community. Still doesn't mean we're not operating without risk. And it still doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of work left to be done. But I'm quite proud of my civil servant friends and my friends in the Department of Defense that have defended this great enterprise for so long. Look, they've been given legacy tools to fight a modern battle, and they've done a yeoman's job at doing that. But we've proven that we can begin to extend how we work, the way we work. We can do it safely. We can apply the principles of risk management, zero trust, and continue to protect, to me, which is one of the most critical sovereign assets, which is the business of our government. But it's been interesting, right? The cybersecurity attacks have been on the rise without question over the last 12 to 14 months. But the cyber warriors and cyber defenders that are in civil service have done an amazing job while also trying to modernize the infrastructure and get access to new tools and new cyber capabilities that are at a premium in the market today.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. The speed with which people adapted and embraced the digital transformation was truly incredible. But, you know, I'd like to focus on something that you mentioned in your response, though. So, you know, obviously there are risks involved with having an entirely digital or a hybrid workforce. What can you tell us about any new threats that have emerged, you know, in the last year? You know, are agencies prepared to take these threats on?
Yeah, what a great follow-up question. It's fascinating. What's old is new again, Kevin. You know, as we work from anywhere and we transition a little bit to this really digitally enabled knowledge worker, right? If you remember many years, we gave the knowledge worker that moniker because of the type of job. It wasn't like a manufacturing job or line worker. There was some higher end intellect that was required to help the knowledge worker. Now we have this digitally enabled knowledge worker to be able to work from anywhere. Now, when I say what's old is new again, It's fascinating. Most cyber defenders, cyber warriors understand that the end user at the device and the end user level is the largest attack surface within the enterprise today. So the new threats really are the same old threats, just in a new format, because we've now decentralized that digitally enabled knowledge worker on where they're working. So as an example, to be more clear and not so ethereal, instead of having agency workers or mission workers coming into a centralized building where I can have a protected centralized network, I can check both physical and logical security as the person enters the building and the facility, screen them for devices that might be emanating, you know, like smartphones or tablets or USB sticks, those types of things. I didn't have that luxury for the last 12 to 14 months as we've kind of worked from anywhere, let's say from the secret level down, so to speak. But applying the great principles of zero trust, creating a cyber aware workforce about, you know, the challenges that were faced out there, you have to give credit to, again, the cyber warriors and defenders, but also just to traditional mission operators that understood, hey, we're operating in an environment that has elevated risk, that maybe before I click on this email that I might not know who that person is or comes from, maybe I'm gonna get my security department to take a look at those links to determine if it's a phishing attempt. So I think that, you know, I really commend the government creating this culture of cyber awareness so that as these threats have emerged on the largest attack surface being the end user community, the agencies have done a great job creating this awareness about cyber and how to operate more securely as an individual mission user. I also think that both the prior administration and this administration has really come out of the gates quite strong in their support of a better cyber posture as a nation. If I look at the current executive order that the Biden administration has released, there's some really great nuggets in there. I know that it's certainly been mixed with mixed reviews, because a lot of people, they were saying, well, how am I gonna develop a plan in 31 days for a zero trust strategy? But what I like about the executive order is it creates inertia, right? Yes, we still have to have good critical thinking to ensure that we're walking through the cyber architectures that we're going to change to better protect agency infrastructure and better protect that digitally enabled knowledge worker. However, what's great about the executive order is it sets KPIs, it sets metrics, and it sets some very clear outcomes, prescriptive outcomes it's seeking to try and drive further enhancing that cyber aware community, whether it be, you know, again, the knowledge worker or the cyber defender.
Right, and obviously that education of both those groups has been a critical component of almost every cybersecurity plan for quite some time. But you mentioned that, you know, this administration and the previous one really tried to focus on cybersecurity, and as you say, the most recent executive order really lit the fire under the feet of many agencies, specifically giving them a fixed deadline to have some documentable progress. So what I'd like to know, you know, from your perspective, is what are these agencies currently doing to meet those stipulations and, you know, combat cyber threats? You know, I guess as an additional follow-up to that question, you know, is there any more that can be done from your perspective?
Yeah, really, really good question. So it always comes back to key principles for me when I'm operating in some sort of digital format or enterprise. And it's always, the key principles are always people, process, and technology. And I think the agencies are beginning to acknowledge that very robustly. So I focused on the people piece initially, right? Creating cyber aware workforce and operators. Then it's about process at that point. And process really begins to become underpinned by this zero trust strategy that we're hearing a lot about today, which has some great pillars and principles associated with it. Now it's emerging, right? There's still some healthy positive tension in the debate around it. But when you look at those principles or those pillars, it's about device trust, right? Do I have a device come on the network that I know I have zero trust in so that I can be able to do things like authenticate the device management, inventory it, et cetera? Then it's about user trust, and we touched a little bit about user trust. Then it's about the network trust, which we refer to as either transport or session. Then it's about giving access to applications, application trust, data trust, and then most importantly, that continued ability to get insight into all the data we're collecting from a cybersecurity perspective. So it's visibility and analytics, and then automation and orchestration in order to get to scale. So when we think of those seven, you know, kind of five pillars, but seven principles to zero trust, that really starts to focus on our process and our technology piece all at the same time. I'm very excited about in this modern age, even though cyber can be a very tricky conversation to be excited, because people sometimes say, hey, are you crazy? Well, no, I mean, it's an exciting thing to be able to protect the government from these types of adversarial events and see people move forward, and being able to innovate is very exciting.
Cameron and I continued discussing some of the many ways that federal IT and defense agencies can continue to prepare for the future of cybersecurity. But to hear his other recommendations, you're going to have to tune in next time, because that is where we are going to leave it for today. Please go to Government Technology Insider to learn more about how the latest technology is influencing, impacting, and improving the ability for government to get work done. I'm Kevin Tierney, and until we talk again, so long. Hello and welcome back to Government Technology Insider. In today's world, the threat of cyber attacks has become a critical part of any discussion about how to make a robust cybersecurity plan. With looming threats from foreign and other unidentified cyber actors, federal organizations today must work to prevent attacks when they are able to, and respond to attacks that occur quickly and effectively. Cybersecurity is not a new focus for the federal government, but with bad actors becoming more vicious, the government is taking a hard look at how they protect their most valuable data. Today we are continuing our conversation with Cameron Sherry, CTO and VP of Pre-Sales Engineering at Dell EMC Federal, about the future of government IT and defense cybersecurity. When we last left off, Cameron and I were in the middle of a discussion on what agencies are currently doing to meet the stipulations of recent cybersecurity executive orders from both the previous and current administration. Right, so I mean obviously there's a lot of work being done to bring those, you know, seven cybersecurity principles that you just outlined into the conversation, you know, when these agencies are considering or working towards their new vision for cybersecurity. But beyond that, is there anything else out there that they can be doing to, you know, prepare to meet these expectations, to meet these demands, to meet these deadlines, you know, in your perspective?
So some of the other things agencies are exploring to be able to leapfrog into these modern capabilities are things like software-defined infrastructure and software-defined data centers. There are some unique advantages as agencies are moving to this. And if you notice, I didn't say cloud, although these are the technologies that underpin cloud. Cloud really has become more of an operating model. And so these agencies that have embraced software-defined, they're able to do some really advanced, sophisticated things very easily with their current workforce. Things like micro-segmenting the network more efficiently and effectively. So when I focus on that pillar that talked about network, that we use the terms transport and session trust, it gives me the opportunity to segregate my network and say, okay, as users come into the enterprise, let's say they're a user that is a budgetary-based person on a program working in a very specific department. Well, maybe I only need to give them access to financial applications and maybe email, right? Email becomes kind of like a common, I'll call it a birthright service. You have to have it to communicate for collaboration on the network. Or they're an HR person. So maybe they don't need access to finance, but they might need access to payroll to ensure to do a rich job on how they execute HR in those environments. So you begin to see this people, process, technology thing emerge quite robustly within the agencies, and then leveraging software-defined capabilities is allowing them to create an inherently more cyber-secure environment using software and infrastructure as code to be able to really drive towards this zero trust principle or zero trust strategy as quickly as they possibly can.
Well, you know, just I guess to so we can really hammer this down, you know, obviously it sounds like one of the biggest recommendations you have for, you know, the question of how can an agency bolster their cybersecurity posture is really embrace that zero trust perspective. Can you explain just for us, you know, what your perspective on the zero trust approach is? You know, what is it? You know, what's the best recommendations for it? And are there any examples that you could share, you know, just to kind of help illustrate, you know, why this is so important and how useful it could be?
Sure. It's fascinating, Kevin. For many years, current thinking in the cybersecurity world really has been rooted in, I'll call them kinetic security principles, like physical world security principles that quite frankly go back as far as jolly old England in a castle and moat type of strategy. And what I mean by that, although it's a bit jovial, the truth still exists. In cyber, when you look at the way people set up, say, remote access for users or access into the network, the current or legacy thinking was once a user was authenticated at, let's say, my bridge or gate that's protected by my moat, and I go, oh, that's John Smith or Sally May, I'm letting them into the castle. And at that point, the legacy thinking was, well, then I'll give them access to everything so that they could perform their job, because I really didn't have a good profile of what their role was. Were they a cook? Were they a knight? Were they a archer? What was their role so that I can arm them with the appropriate tools and capabilities to be able to perform their job? So literally that was the thinking. We refer to it a lot as the castle and moat principle. In today's world, because we can do things more quickly with greater agility in a software-defined infrastructure mindset, I can take that same principle, but say, wait a minute, the same John Smith or Sally May I let into the castle, I may want to stop them at the lobby. And I may want to say, oh, John Smith, you're an archer. So the only thing you need is a bow and an arrow. And I'm going to show you very prescriptively how to get to the top of the castle to defend it. Sally May, oh, you're a nurse. You're here to provide some healthcare to somebody. Well, you need tools and access to those person's health records, which, by the way, comes with a compliance mechanism. So I have to validate who you are so that you can have viable access to those records and that you handle them with the appropriate HIPAA high-tech requirements. So I'm only going to give you access to those systems. And by the way, the infirmary is to the right here. That's all I'm going to let you into. So although these examples are colorful and they're interesting, but they're easy to follow, because as we apply those principles to the enterprise, it's the same application. It's about assuming everything is corrupt, the data, the applications, et cetera, and the user, you are validating the user in steps along the way so that once they get into your remote firewalls, your DMZs, or your RAS setups for remote access, you are then articulating very prescriptively what tools and what data they have access and what applications they have access to that are specific and suited for their role.
Absolutely. I mean, as a bit of a fantasy nerd myself, I appreciate the comparison and the analogy. But it does really illustrate the point well that, you know, Zero Trust isn't a product. It isn't a solution that you can, you know, purchase and kind of cross it off your list. It's a whole agency approach to thinking about cybersecurity.
And you apropos said, Kevin, it's not a silver bullet. We like to look for those a lot in technology and hopefully, oh yeah, if you just buy this one tool, it'll solve all your problems and serve you a hot latte in the morning at exactly 104 degrees. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen. It is a set of principles you have to abide by. It is a combination of software and how software integrates with hardware. And it is about understanding the demographic of your user community. So I think that's really the clearest way to explain like the principles behind Zero Trust and what we're doing with that in the software-defined world.
Our conversation continued as Cameron pivoted towards explaining the role that Zero Trust can play in safeguarding valuable data and whether a Zero Trust approach could be a part of the answer to government security worries. But to hear the rest of Cameron's thoughts on the matter, you're going to have to tune in next time, because that is where we're going to leave off for today. please go to Government Technology Insider to learn more about how the latest technology is influencing, impacting, and improving the ability for government to get work done. I'm Kevin Tierney, and until we talk again, so long. Hello and welcome back to Government Technology Insider. In today's world, the threat of cyber attacks has become a critical part of any discussion about how to make a robust cybersecurity plan. With looming threats from foreign and other unidentified cyber actors, federal organizations today must work to prevent attacks when they are able to and respond to attacks that occur quickly and effectively. Cybersecurity is not a new focus for the federal government, but with bad actors becoming more vicious, the government is taking a hard look at how they protect their most valuable data. Today, we conclude our conversation with Cameron Sherry, CTO and Vice President of Pre-Sales Engineering at Dell EMC Federal, about the future of government IT and defense cybersecurity. Cameron and I had just finished discussing what Zero Trust means for cybersecurity in the federal and defense IT space, but I wanted to get his perspective on the longevity of the approach and whether it truly could be a solid foundation for a robust cybersecurity plan for the foreseeable future. Well, so let me ask you the million-dollar question then. I mean, when we look at the zero trust approach to cybersecurity, you know, how can it defend and secure valuable data for the government and for defense? And do you kind of see this as the answer to government security worries moving forward?
I do. I think zero trust absolutely can help in a variety of ways. You know, the government, I don't think people appreciate as much if you don't work in the environment, just the extent of data the government must collect to be compliant with its own regulatory environment. It's just like any other highly regulated industry, whether you're in financial services and you have a fiduciary responsibility, let's say you're managing a hedge fund, you have SEC compliance you have to contend with, or if you work in the credit card industry, you have PCI DSS, healthcare, HIPAA, high tech. You know, there's an extraordinary amount of data that has to be checked from a compliance perspective or collected. So it really causes or poses a very unique challenge in the government segment. But zero trust, I believe, when you start to really think about a couple of the key pillars that I like to refer to, specifically around application trust and data trust, I think it's a good trajectory for us to get on a healthier path with government agencies. And there's some very prescriptive tactical things that we can do at relatively low to no cost to the government. As an example, how you do backup and recovery, how those backups are accessed, who has access to them, and how do you access those backups? So it comes back to that same people, process, and technology principle. Well, maybe from a people perspective, I only want the backup engineers associated with backup to be able to get access to it. Okay, great. Then from a process, they're the only authorized person, or the mission user or system owner is the only person that can authorize retrieving that data from backup. And maybe I isolate that backup off of the current mission or operational network onto its own air gap, either logically or physically air gap network, so that if I do have an adversary on my network, they're not getting access to that type of soft penetration point like data backups. And then from a technology perspective, use things like encryption, just as good hygiene today. And most software today uses encryption everywhere, which is a good safe practice. So I do think doing some of those very simple practical things that create a good hygiene and good practice that underpin these zero trust strategies is outstanding. I think the second pillar when we talk about application trust, I've said this in the past, and I'm very passionate about this. I think that digital transformation and modernization should be considered a national imperative. I'm not a person that believes, you know, you should create a crisis environment to get people to move. However, creating it as a national imperative will help us focus on legacy systems where there may just not be the best business case from a modernization or attrition perspective. You know, dealing with technical debt, those types of things, it's a complicated conversation. But being able to modernize your applications and rethinking these new security principles that exist in our today's DevOps and SecDevOps processes that just didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago, just that modernization strategy alone with a distinct focus on security, which is part of the Zero Trust principles, I think will help government agencies tremendously when we think about data and, more importantly, the applications that access that data.
Right. So there's obviously a lot that the Zero Trust approach can do, you know, for these agencies in the present. You know, there's a good reason why so many people are really lauding it and talking about it and really fixating on it as like the new big thing. But I guess looking a bit longer term, over the next year, over the next 2 years, with how the cybersecurity landscape evolves so rapidly, do you see Zero Trust remaining as relevant today as it will be in the next year, in the next 2 years?
Yeah, what a great question, because as you very much alluded to, Kevin, in your question, our industry is very much focused on the shiny new toy syndrome each year, because let's face it, most of the industry is based on selling and sales, and we have to kind of create that momentum. I would offer you, though, very much like the kill chain principles we've had in the days of old when we think of cyber, I think Zero Trust is going to be one of those emerging strategies and trends that will stay around for quite a period of time, and there's a few reasons for it. The principles of Zero Trust, when you look at them as a practitioner, they go far beyond just a singular product or technology. It is about changing the thinking of how we think about users in the environment. And I want to be clear here, Kevin, all users are not nefarious. They're all users that are distinctly focused on a mission execution. They have integrity. They have all these things that we expect out of the users of these environments. However, user credentials can get compromised, sometimes without the users even knowing. It happens even to the best of us. So it's not a matter of if, it's when. So when you think of principles like Zero Trust and starting with, let's say, the user community, you know, simple attributes that are evolving are like, let me authenticate the device on the network. When I do that, I can authenticate its hardware. I can authenticate the software. I can authenticate the management of that device, do an inventory on it to ensure that it may not be a dirty device, even if it's a BYOB type of device, bring your own, or BYOD device. That's a little Freudian slip, Kevin. I don't think we're bringing many bottles of anything to work. We're certainly bringing some sort of device. But then when I move to the second pillar, and I think of user trust, you know, there's nothing wrong with multi-factor authentication. We use it in every aspect of our lives as end users today. You know, if you've logged into your banking application recently, you know, they say, hey, thank you for logging in, John Smith. I'm sending your code to your cell phone. Is this still your cell phone number? You put in the additional PIN. It's a very user-friendly way to do multi-factor authentication. And then, as you know, logging into your banking app, it aligns your bank number, your account number specifically to you, so you don't see anyone else's data. So that again, used in a very prescriptive manner. And then when I think of the network and session trust, micro-segmentation, encrypting the network itself, and just protecting the session using encryption, these are just great hygienic strategies to use. To be able to continue to protect the network, because we know the network, typically the adversary's already on it. You know, not even the best cyber operators will tell you, as comfortable as I am defending this network, I'm confident that there's an adversary on it. So other hygiene, like not passing passwords in the clear, or using encryption when you're doing password authentication or password sign-in. So those are great things that I think you'll see. Same thing with application trust. SecDevOps has been a great strategy that's come around. And then again, data trust, continuing to focus on how do I protect data at rest? How do I protect it in motion? Am I doing a good job of my metadata classification so that I have good data classification and some sort of good data loss prevention? I think all of this, when you look at the visibility analytics, the automation and orchestration, and because of the pervasive nature and usage of software defined and the infrastructure today, You're really going to see, I think, a much more rapid adoption of these principles in the coming 12, 24, and 36 months as a direct result of the pandemic proving out that we can move a little quicker than what we may have in the past. We can stay ahead of, not on par with, our nation state peers. And we can really get ahead to a security posture that makes much better sense to execute just such a great mission, which is, you know, the sovereign mission of our U.S. government. So I think that'll happen on the adoption side. I think in the industry side, you're going to see some consolidation occur. I think that the private equity money, venture capital money that's on the sidelines right now will come out and look to consolidate the cyber market. I think one thing is users, that we get user fatigue in the cyber world, is there's always these very point, strategic, targeted, just niche tools that solve a very thin problem or very discrete problem. There's not a broad set of capabilities. So I think a consolidation in the market's going to be extraordinarily healthy. And ultimately, I think it's going to help the user community in that consolidation. So I'm very excited. I'm always eager. I'm a technology optimist, but I'm very excited what I see over the next 12 to 24 months.
Absolutely. It's the best part about working in this field is that, you know, there's always something interesting and new on the horizon that we can look forward to hearing more about in the future. But for now, you know, those are all the questions that I had, and I think you really answered them all excellently, Cameron. You know, we got a lot to digest from this, and obviously really appreciate you coming onto the show, you know, coming to bring your insights and sharing just some of the information that you share with us today. Really appreciate it. And, you know, I hope we can talk again sometime in the future.
Thank you so much, Kevin. I hope the audience found it informative and hopefully a little entertaining along the way. Really appreciate the time and the thoughtful questions.
Please go to Government Technology Insider to learn more about how the latest technology is influencing, impacting, and improving the ability for government to get work done. I'm Kevin Tierney. And until we talk again, so long.